Hi, Big Army here. This is For the Record, program number 1165. Farewell America, Part 4, The Reeve Whitson File, Part 2. This is being recorded on Sunday, November 22nd of the year 2020, the anniversary, of course, of the assassination of JFK. In this program, we're going to continue with our reading from a very important book, a book that I recommend most emphatically. I have no connection financially to the author or the publisher or anything about it, no economic skin in the game. This is simply a very important recent book and one that I recommend now that we are in holiday gift-giving season. That book is called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 1960s, or the 60s. It is offered by Tom O'Neill, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 2019. To make a very long story very short, this book is about, at one level, the operations of the, quote, Manson family, unquote, in the 1960s. It also is about the 1960s. Tom O'Neill makes a very good, albeit circumstantial, case that, in fact, the Manson family was a domestic intelligence operation, part of, various turns, Operation Chaos, the CIA's domestic program to disrupt or neutralize the anti-Vietnam War movement and related political elements, the FBI's COINTELPRO program of a similar orientation, and a domestic Phoenix program. The Phoenix program being a program of assassination and terror in South Vietnam, part of whose MO was to commit atrocities and massacres that would be blamed on the Viet Cong, thereby winning, quote, hearts and minds, unquote. I have selected the remarkable resume of a veteran intelligence officer, probably CIA and very possibly working for other elements at the same time, a guy named Reeve Whitson, first name capital R-E-E-V-E, second name capital W-H-I-T-S-O-N, a veteran intelligence officer. He had more connections than a switchboard. He appears to have had the Cielo Drive home where Sharon Tate and company were killed under surveillance on the night of the killings, and notified an associate, Sharok Hatami, who was Sharon Tate's photographer, before the police had actually discovered the killings. At one point, when it was believed for a moment by associates of Whitson that Whitson himself may have been among the victims at Cielo Drive, the LAPD set up a command center at Whitson's parents' home, a very unusual thing. Whitson appears to have been involved in various aspects of the Manson case, including, as we are about to see, working under the alias of Walter Kern, last name capital K-E-R-N, and working with not only an LAPD captain involved with the overseeing the Manson investigation itself, but also Colonel Paul Tate, Sharon Tate's father and a veteran military intelligence officer, and an FBI agent named Frenchie Vajernes, who, that last name, capital L-A, capital J-E-U-N-E-S-S-E. He also was working on the Manson case. As illustrated, as I mentioned, I should say, in the first program about the Reeve Whitson file, I think in many ways, Reeve Whitson embodies the death of American democracy, and his remarkable career and the many, many connections that he had, I think, are something of a mausoleum for American democracy in the wake of Donald Trump's defeat and attempts at overturning the presidential election. Many people have spoken about our democracy being under threat. Our democracy got its brains blown all over a limousine in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd, 1963, and it has been for show ever since. Indeed, as we will see later on in the in this program, Tom O'Neill wound up being pulled into aspects of the JFK assassination by his investigation into the Manson case. We'll talk more about that later. Overlapping what we're going to read in this program with what we read in our last, we're going to plunge right in with Tom O'Neill's account of Reed Whitson. O'Neill writes, "In chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the secret history of the 60s as follows." In a section called Mr. Anonymous, unquote, O'Neill writes, "As usual, I was anxious to find some way to verify everything I had heard. With Whitson, especially, my reporting had crossed the line into conspiratorial territory, and I would be hard-pressed to convert skeptics on the merits of my interviews alone. Of course, clandestine intelligence agents are exactly the sort of people who do not leave a lot of paper behind, and Reed Whitson, by all accounts, was so savvy that he didn't need to take notes at all. I'd filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the CIA, asking for any information they had about Reed Whitson. Their response said that they could, quote, neither confirm nor deny, unquote, Whitson's connection to the agency. Freedom of Information Act specialists told me that this is the closest one can get to confirmation that someone actually worked for the CIA. I did eventually find corroboration in print, but it came in a strange form. A manuscript from an unpublished book called Five Down on CLO Drive, written around 1974 or 1975, before Helter Skelter, and thus before Bugliosi's telling of the Manson story had ossified into the official, unquote, narrative. The book had a tortured history, not least because it involved at least three authors. The most prominent of these was Lieutenant Robert Helder, capital H-E-L-D-E-R, who headed the LAPD's investigation into the Tate murders. Another contributor was Sharon Tate's father, Colonel Paul Tate. The third author was Roger Frenchy Lajeunesse, an FBI agent who unofficially, unquote, assisted the LAPD. It's not hard to see the appeal of the book, especially before Helter Skelter. Here were three authorities on the case who could give a rich account of it when no such account existed. They secured a contract with a publisher when too much time passed without a viable book. A ghostwriter came on board, but by the time the manuscript was ready, Bugliosi had beaten them to the punch, and his Helter Skelter had claimed the mantle of official, unquote, Manson book. The deal fell through. In the ensuing years, the Five Down manuscript gained a reputation among researchers and obsessives. It was exceptionally rare. Hardly anyone other than its authors had read it, and even though it was apparently tedious, it was rumored to have the most complete account of the LAPD's investigation, false leads and all. Another journalist passed me a copy. I read the parts about Colonel Tate especially closely. A retired military intelligence officer, Tate had mounted his own inquiry into his daughter's death, separate from, but parallel to, the LAPD's. Many had told me that Whitson was under his wing. You wouldn't think that LAPD detectives would have been so keen on two outsiders helping them, especially given those outsiders' connections to intelligence agencies, but a Los Angeles Sheriff's Office detective told me that Colonel Tate, quote, appeared to be running the LAPD. Interesting, again, this last statement. You wouldn't think that LAPD detectives would have been so keen on two outsiders helping them, especially given those outsiders' connections to intelligence agencies. But a Los Angeles Sheriff's Office detective told me that Colonel Tate, quote, appeared to be running the LAPD, unquote. Then in his mid-40s, Tate had only recently left the Army. To mount his independent, unquote, investigation, he tried to masquerade as a laid-back Californian, growing a beard and long hair. But he retained the upright carriage of a military officer as he wandered into hippie clubs and drug dens in search of his daughter's murderer, offering a lavish reward to anyone who would help. How did Whitson play into this? The five-down manuscript refers to a Walter Kern, K-E-R-N, quote, a somewhat shady character who can best be described as a police groupie. Apparently, he had been a friend of Jay Sebring, parenthetically a hairstylist, who was one of the victims at Cielo Drive, beginning again. Apparently, he had been a friend of Jay Sebring and wanted to help in any way he could, unquote. Kern, unquote, was always one step ahead of the other investigators. Helder wrote, quote, in this business, as you might imagine, a policeman gets to meet many strange people. Kern was among the strangest. No one knew what he did for a living, yet he always seemed to have money and knew just about everyone on the wrong side of the tracks. I didn't like him, but he was useful, unquote. And he kept popping up. When Helder arrived to interview Roman Polanski at the Paramount lot where he was sequestered with Witold Kaczynowski, Kern was there, quote, lurking in the shadows. He sure did get around, unquote. Believing that Wojtek Frykowski, another of the victims, by the way, of the killings at Cielo Drive, believing that Wojtek Frykowski was involved with drug dealers who might have murdered him, Helder instructed Kern to cozy up to anyone who might know them, especially those in Mama Cass's circle. That's Mama Cass of the Mamas and the Papas singing group. In another section of the manuscript, quote, a Hollywood hooker, unquote, is said to have spoken to Kern, quote, who by now was well known as an amateur sleuth on the case, unquote. Kern shared leads and took orders, and yet the man was so shrouded in mystery that Helder referred to him as, quote, Mr. Anonymous, unquote. It seemed likely to me that there was more to Mr. Anonymous than Helder had shared. By that point, Helder had died, but I had already spoken to Roger Frenchy Lajeunesse, the FBI agent who had contributed to Five Down. I called him to ask whether Walter Kern was really Reeve Whitson. His answer, yes, unquote. In fact, the publishing deal couldn't have happened without Whitson, Lajeunesse said. Reeve Whitson was a part of putting the book together, the linchpin between all of us, unquote. So again, apparently Reed Whitson, according to help to Lajeunesse, Reed Whitson was really sort of the straw that stirred this particular drink. Again, one more time. I called Roger Lajeunesse to ask him whether Walter Kern was really Reed Whitson. His answer, yes. In fact, the publishing deal couldn't have happened without Whitson, Lajeunesse said. Reed Whitson was a part of putting the book together, the linchpin between all of us, unquote. It was Lieutenant Helder, the lead investigator for the LAPD, who assigned Whitson the pseudonym of Walter Kern to protect his undercover status, hardly a step one would take with an ordinary amateur sleuth, unquote. Quote, Reeve did not want his name associated with a book, Lajeunesse said, even long after the Manson case had been solved, quote, not on the jacket, not even in contracts. He didn't even want money, unquote. In effect, I now have written proof from the LAPD's head investigator and from Sharon Pape's own father that Reeve Wilson was smack in the middle of the Manson investigation from the start. Lajeunesse didn't know who Whitson worked for, just that he was an astounding fellow, unquote, who'd been an informant of some kind. He, quote, wanted to project an aura of mystery, unquote, Lajeunesse said, but the heart of his motivation was an anti-drug conservatism. He was, quote, interested in keeping young people away from the curse of narcotics, unquote. Mike McGann, the LAPD detective whom I've interviewed about the early days of the investigation, remembered Whitson's involvement as well. Quote, he was heavily involved, McGann said, and he had no need for money. McGann was nearly certain that Whitson was in the CIA and found him very credible, unquote. Still, when I said that Whitson had reportedly believed he could have stopped the murders, McGann laughed, quote, bull S blank blank blank. He talked for 3 hours and never say anything. Typical government employee. A real good line of bull, S blank blank blank, unquote. If I could prove once and for all that Whitson was working for the CIA, even McGann might admit I had a story on my hands. The CIA wasn't even supposed to operate on domestic soil. What could they have been doing messing around with an acid-soaked cult in Los Angeles? And if Whitson had been close enough to the murders to stop them, why didn't he? Everyone agreed that Paul Pate was the key to understanding Whitson. I knew that Pate was still alive, but getting him to open up would be a long shot. His wife, Anne Sharon Tate's mother, Doris, had been comfortable discussing the murder. She'd formed a national victims' rights advocacy group and mobilized it whenever anyone from the family was eligible for parole. Her friends said she believed there was something deeper than helter-skelter behind the murders. By the way, that was the race war cover story for the Manson killings. They supposedly were going to commit killings that would then be blamed on the black people and the Black Panthers, starting a race war at the end of which somehow the Manson people would take over. So that is the reference to helter-skelter. Speaking again of Doris Tate, her friends said she believed that there was something deeper than helter-skelter behind the murders. Like her husband, she conducted her own investigation through the years, becoming convinced that the Cielo House was under surveillance by some type of law enforcement at the time of the murders. Whether she knew that Ree Whitson had claimed to be watching the house, we'll never know. She was also sure that her daughter was not supposed to be home when the killers arrived that night. Whoever was watching the house, she believed, had noticed that Sharon's red Ferrari was not parked in the driveway. It was in the repair shop, and thus concluded that she was not there. She planned to write a book about her theories, but she never got to. She was diagnosed with cancer and died in 1992. Paul Tate, rumor had it, had never discussed the case with his wife. Before she died, they'd barely spoken to each other, having taken up in separate parts of their house. He hadn't spoken publicly about Sharon's death since Manson had been captured, and he'd already declined an interview with me once. But I phoned him again in May of 2000, telling him I'd gotten a copy of Five Down on Cielo Drive and planned to quote it. That got him to agree to meet with me. But as the date approached, he canceled on me. We rescheduled, and he canceled again. When he called to cancel yet another meeting, I tried to butt in with a question about Ree Whitson before he could give off the phone. He was receptive, at first, anyway. Reeve was my main person to help me, Tate said. He's been a friend of Roman Polanski and Sharon and mine, and Jay Sebring. He was very, very helpful, unquote. Even so, Pete found it ridiculous that Whitson's friends were going around saying that he could have prevented the murders. That simply wasn't true, he said. could be helping to clear it up, having contributed so much to the investigation. Quote, I contributed just put in there, I contributed nothing, unquote. But you were involved in the investigation, I said. You wrote a book about it. Yeah, well, did you ask Reeve to do the undercover work, or did someone else? I'm not going to answer those questions, unquote, he said, impatience creeping into his voice. Could he at least tell me who Whitson worked for? He refused. Why not? I don't have to tell you that, he merely shouted. Out of desperation, I made a foolish mistake. Sometimes, when I sensed that someone was withholding something sensitive, I'd remind the person that, in all the speculation about Manson himself, the basic, brutal loss of human life was too often the first thing people stopped thinking about. So I said, quote, just out of respect to the victims, don't you think? Paul Pape sounded a million miles away to me, and he had a gruff, emotionally detached tone befitting his military background. But he was, first and foremost, Sharon Tate's father, a man who'd lost a child to an unimaginable horror, who'd seen her death become a kind of shorthand for tabloid atrocities. I'd forgotten that truth, and my comment understandably upset him. I regretted it right away. Out of respect for the victims, he shouted, what kind of F-blank-blank-blank do you think I am, unquote. He laughed bitterly. You go ahead and you do whatever you want to do, but if any son of a B-blank-blank-blank ever had respect for the victims, it was me, unquote. I apologize, I said. I didn't mean it to sound the way it came out. Okay, he said, bye-bye. And that was the end of my relationship with Paul Pape, the man who knew better than anyone what Reeve Whitson was up to. Paul Pape died in 2005. And next, the section called The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Helder had written that Whitson, quote, knew just about everyone on the wrong side of the tracks, unquote. The opposite was true, too. He knew how to pull the levers of power. Colonel Paul Pape was just one of his friends in high places. Usually, in the same breath, Whitson's friends named another military bigwig, General Curtis LeMay. Parenthetically, before we continue, Curtis LeMay had been Air Force Chief of Staff when JFK was killed. He was known, first of all, for having crafted the firebombing raids on Tokyo in World War II. He then became a hardcore Cold Warrior, felt that JFK's behavior was quasi-treasonous, and garnered the attention and ire of a number of people at JFK's autopsy by smoking a cigar. General Curtis LeMay, after leaving the Air Force, became the vice presidential candidate in 1968 for George Wallace, who was running on a segregationist platform. George Wallace, by the way, in 1972, was shot and critically wounded by someone. It was not Arthur Bremer who took the fall for the killings. Arthur Bremer had the paraffin tests on him were negative. He had not fired a gun. And interestingly, there are some evidentiary tributaries running between the Manson killings and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and also the shooting of George Wallace. We'll talk about those in The Guns of November, Part 4, and in AFA Program Number 9. Time permitting, I'll review some of that later on in the program. Worth noting, though, that General Curtis LeMay was very, very close to Reeve Whitson, and after retirement, he went to work as the vice president of a missile parts contracting company that, in turn, was headed up by a former Romanian Iron Guard general. More about that later on in this discussion. Continuing with Tom O'Neill's chaos, as discussed earlier, LeMay was part of the unsettling story I've heard from Jay Sebring's barber, Little Joe. One of Sebring's clients, the mobster Charlie Barron, had called Joe after Sebring's murder, pledging that no harm would come to the barber. Charlie Barron was a friend of Curtis LeMay as well. Meetings between the two were noted by the FBI, who surveilled Barron for decades. LeMay, a former Air Force officer named Bombsaway LeMay, unquote, had retired in 1965 and turned to defense contracting, where one critic feared that he, quote, could be more dangerous than when he was Air Force Chief of Staff, unquote. LeMay moved to Los Angeles to become the vice president of a missile parts manufacturer. But it fizzled, as did LeMay's brief political career. After that, Mr. Bombsaway had spent his retirement roaming the city with Mr. Anonymous, Reeve Whitson. I added a few more connected arrows to the big whiteboard on my wall, realizing more than ever that its tangle of lines and circles made sense only to me. Though I never figured out what LeMay and Whitson got up to together, it was plausible that they were tied up in Charlie Barron's cabal of right-wing Hollywood friends, the ones who, Little Joe told me, had done terrible things to black people, unquote. George Wallace, who'd chosen LeMay as his running mate in his 1968 presidential bid, was among the nation's most notorious racists. I'm sure he knew Barron, Whitson's friend John Irvin told me, a British film director who himself claimed to have ties to MI5. Irvin said that Whitson got meetings, quote, within minutes, unquote, at the highest levels of the defense industry, unquote. It was amazing, this last bit again. A British film director who himself claimed to have ties to MI5, Irvin said that Whitson got meetings, quote, within minutes, unquote, at the highest levels of the defense industry. It was amazing, unquote. He was, quote, on the fringes of very far-out research, unquote, for the government, quote, not discussed openly because it verges on the occult, unquote. He added that Whitson, quote, had very good connections with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, unquote, and pulled with immigration officials as well, as Sherlock Hatami had claimed. But Irvin couldn't elaborate on any of this. Then came Otto and Ilsa Skorzeny, the most sinister of Whitson's friends. They were Nazis, genuine German, dyed-in-the-wool Nazis. The United Nations listed Otto Skorzeny as a war criminal. He'd been one of Hitler's most trusted operatives, leading the manhunt of one of the Führer's would-be assassins and spearheading a secret mission to rescue Mussolini. After the Third Reich fell, Skorzeny safeguarded the wealth of countless Nazis and helped disgraced war criminals settle into new lives around the world. Brought to trial before a U.S. military court, Skorzeny was alleged to be, quote, the most dangerous man in Europe, unquote, but he was acquitted, having made himself an asset to U.S. intelligence. His wife, the Countess Ilse von Finkelstein, was once a member of the Hitler Youth, a shrewd businesswoman known for her beauty and charm. She negotiated arms deals and contracts for German engineering companies. Irvin had met Ilse many times through Whitson. When she got drunk, he said, she was always doing Heil Hitler salutes, unquote. Whitson could look past any ideology, no matter how abhorrent, if someone proved useful to him. His friends construed him as the purest form of cold warrior lifted from the spy who came in from the cold. He carried an outmoded 50s-era politics into the future, masquerading as a hippie, infiltrating an LSD cult, and befriending Nazis to eliminate the scourge of communism and narcotics, the latter being, to his mind, a direct extension of the former. He believed there was an operation to destabilize American youth, unquote, one friend told me, Russians were bringing drugs in to battle the American system from within, unquote. Because typically it was just the opposite. It was quite true that someone was disseminating drugs to destabilize American youth, but it was elements of the CIA and related forces. Continuing. Having worked in South America, Woodson believed, quote, we should kill the drug lords in Bolivia and their whole families. If there's a baby, you kill the baby. I don't think he would say something like that and not be capable of doing it. He didn't believe in the individual, but in the larger picture, unquote. Another acquaintance recalled, quote, the entire Manson situation, the Black Panther movement, and probably similar other movements, people like that were discredited, beginning again, the entire Manson situation, the Black Panther movement, and probably similar other movements, people like that were discredited by certain things that, according to Reed Whitson, may have been staged or done by government authorities in order to make them look bad. One more time. The entire Manson situation, the Black Panther movement, and probably similar other movements, people like that were discredited by certain things that, according to Reed Whitson, may have been staged or done by government authorities in order to make them look bad, unquote. That's sort of a thesis statement for the entire book. Continuing. If I could find out where Whitson's money came from, I might be closer to understanding what he actually did. His resume was scant from the 50s through the 70s, after which it covered more ground than seemed possible for a single life. Whitson was the special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thyssen AG, among the largest corporations in Germany. Now, of course, it is ThyssenKrupp, and it is the largest heavy industrial concern in Western Europe, and the Thyssen interests were a key part of the Third Reich, key part of the Bormann organization, and the Bush family are inextricably linked with the operations of the Thyssen Group. And again, Whitson, special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thyssen, also a close personal friend of both Otto Skorzeny and his wife, as we have seen in many programs, including our series 1146 through 1150, the space plane and COVID-19, the paperclip legacy. Otto Skorzeny was a key functionary of the post-World War II Nazi diaspora and also the Galen organization, both when it was part of CIA and when it was the BND. Turning back now to Reed Whitson and the account presented here by Tom O'Neill. Whitson sank years into a scheme to construct a maglev, M-A-G-L-E-V, monorail train stretching from Las Vegas to Pasadena. He wanted to build a Brigadoon theme park in Scotland. He was involved in weapons manufacturing, early iterations of the Miss Universe pageant, parenthetically eventually assumed by Donald Trump, and a new variety of childproof medicine bottle. And he had a passion for race cars, building them, selling them, driving them, which may explain how he befriended Jay Sebring, another racing enthusiast. These ventures all had one thing in common. They fell through. The easiest explanation, of course, was that they were covers, and sometimes Whitson told friends as much. So where did his money come from? No one knew. He always paid in cash. He stowed that in his freezer, and when he had it, he was quick to settle a tab. Whitson dressed in gabardine suits, but for much of his adult life, an ex-girlfriend recalled, he lived, quote, like a hermit, unquote, sleeping, quote, on a cot in his parents' kitchen, unquote. The man who loved fast cars drove an economical Ford Pinto. In his final years, Whitson was destitute and disgruntled, telling rueful stories of the quarry, unquote, his term for the section of the CIA he worked for, and trash-talking the agency. Once you're in, he told one friend, you really are a pawn, unquote. In his dying days, the government had said, quote, "You didn't even exist to us," unquote. Even the movies were no reprieve, offering reminders of his glory days. About a year before he died, seeing the thriller The Pelican Brief, Whitson leaned over in the dark of the cinema and told a friend, quote, "I wrote the yellow papers on everything that happened," unquote. With a hint of nostalgia, he explained that yellow papers, unquote, detailed interrogation techniques, including a procedure Whitson devised in which a man had a plastic tube inserted into his rectum, peanut butter smeared on his scrotum, and a rat dropped into the tube. Whitson died at the relatively young age of 63. With no health insurance, he left behind an enormous unpaid hospital bill, something to the tune of $500,000. A few of my sources felt there may have been foul play. He'd given conflicting explanations for his health problems, a heart attack, or a spider bite, or a brain tumor, or lymphoma, quote, "I think he committed suicide," unquote, his daughter told me. "His greatest fear was to be a vegetable," unquote. Reed Whitson was a walk-in, unquote, as one of my sources put it, an extraterrestrial, unquote. Once he consumed me, I found myself fixating on possibilities that I would have dismissed as insane only months before. Whitson's life opened onto a vantage of intrigue where Manson and the 60s counterculture were just one element in a political struggle that encompassed Nazis, Cuba, Vietnam, South America, military intelligence, and Byzantine matters of national security. Indeed, that is something of a thesis statement, I think, for the entire book. It's why I'm talking about Reed Whitson and his career, because I think that when one takes a look at the landscape that was occupied by Reed Whitson, one can basically take a good look at America in the 1950s. Really, as Tom O'Neill puts it, speaking of Whitson, his life opened onto a vantage of intrigue where Manson and the 60s counterculture were just one element in a political struggle that encompassed Nazis, Cuba, Vietnam, South America, military intelligence, and Byzantine matters of national security. Well, they most assuredly did. And of Whitson's association with Curtis LeMay. Bear in mind that, as Tom O'Neill wrote, after retiring from the Air Force, Whitson became the vice president of a missile parts manufacturer. Now, more about that in an end note on page 463. Vice president of a missile parts manufacturer. LeMay was hired by Networks Electronic in 1965. The high-security facility, which had a contract with the Defense Department, was located in Chatsworth, California, less than 5 miles from the Spahn Ranch. That was where the Manson family were taking up residence. Continuing, the company's founder and president, Mihai, capital M-I-H-A-I, Patrici, capital P-A-T-R-I-C-H-I, was a former Romanian army general who was a member of the Iron Guard, a far-right political group in Romania. Well, it was far more than a far-right political group. The Iron Guard, of course, were the Romanian allies of Nazi Germany, and they too became a key element of the Galen spy organization. And when that jumped to the CIA, or the fledgling CIA at the end of the war, the Iron Guard were incorporated into the Republican Party's Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, the Nazi branch of the Republican Party, which, as we have looked at in many programs, most recently, the aforementioned series, the Space Plane and COVID-19, the Paperclip Legacy, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council was basically a Nazi wing of the Republican Party that was inextricably linked with the Galen Organization and the CIA, both when the Galen Org was working for CIA and when it became, quote, independent, unquote, as the BND. The Republican Party and its Ethnic Outreach Council are basically an element of continuity from the Third Reich to the CIA to the Republican Party, stretching all the way from late 1944 on up through the present. And so it is more than a little significant, I believe, that the firm that for which Curtis LeMay became the vice president, Networks Electronic, was headed up by an Iron Guard general named Mihai Patrici, P-A-T-R-I-C-H-I. Bear in mind, as Tom O'Neill mentioned, Reed Whitson was palling around all over Los Angeles at the time with the newly retired Curtis LeMay. That is more than a little interesting. Bear in mind, too, Whitson's association with Otto Skorzeny and his wife Ilsa, and also the fact that Reed Whitson was the special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thiessen. Basically, Whitson, among his many connections, obviously, were to what I have called the Underground Reich and its milieu. In For the Record program number 809, among others, we detailed connections between the Manson killings and the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were among Robert Kennedy's key campaign aides in the L.A. area, and at a dinner at the Cielo Drive house the evening before before Robert Kennedy was killed, he told the assembled guests that, as he had told many other people, that after he got the Democratic nomination and became president, he was going to reopen the investigation into his brother's murder. Of course, he never got the chance to do that. One of the people who crops up in connection with the assassination of Robert Kennedy was a fellow named the Reverend Jerry Owen, also called the Walking Bible, unquote. We've talked about him at great length in AFA program number 9. He is a central figure in the book The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by John Christian and William Turner that we used extensively in AFA program number 9. One of Jerry Owen's religious followers, I should say, was a woman named Gail Aiken, A-I-K-E-N, who was the sister of Arthur Bremer, who was the patsy for the shooting of George Wallace in 1972. When Wallace was shot and disabled by someone, Arthur Bremer was the patsy. Again, the paraffin tests on Bremer were negative. That basically knocked George Wallace out of the 72 campaign, and it was feared by some that if he ran as an independent, as he did in 1968, with Curtis LeMay as his vice president, that George Wallace might pull enough of the racist vote away from Richard Nixon to give the victory to the Democrats in 1972. So the shooting of George Wallace eliminated that, and Gail Aiken, Arthur Bremer's sister, was a close associate of the Reverend Jerry Owen, one of the people who may very well have been a handler of Sirron Sirons. In the aforementioned For the Record program 809, we also took a look at Ed Butler, his role in helping to paint Oswald red, functioning in a similar fashion at a news conference after the killing of Robert Kennedy, in which he gave indications that Robert Kennedy may have had some links to the, not Robert Kennedy, but Sirron Sirons may have had links to Castro's Cuba. And then later, Ed Butler, writing for the Aware newspaper, linked the Cielo Drive killings and the Pate LaBianca killings to, quote, the Black Panthers, unquote. That was the cover story of the, quote, Helter Skelter, unquote, race or surface explanation for the Manson family's operations. I would note, as people are bemoaning the death of our democracy, but then enthusiastically talking about how Joe Biden is, you know, is going to revive America, etc. Here's Vice President-elect Kamala Harris as Attorney General of California threw cold water on the Pence to parole Saran Saran, who is provably innocent. The physical evidence in the assassination of Robert Kennedy exonerates Saran. Nonetheless, Kamala Harris refused to permit Saran Saran to be paroled. In our last program, I spoke very highly of Tom O'Neill, the author of this book. As I mentioned, despite the fact that the investigation that O'Neill was engaged in went way beyond just the surface and the better known aspects of the Manson case, and to his credit, Tom O'Neill followed the evidentiary tributaries wherever they led, and they often led to some things that, just most people would not have touched. As I noted in the interview I did with Tom O'Neill for the record program 1085, and in some of our discussions of his book, the role of the intelligence community and the national security establishment in the Manson case might be seen as analogous to the powerful gravitational field of a distant star, which has been observed by astronomers to bend the path of light, thereby giving them proof of the existence of that powerful gravitational field by a star they could not see, because the gravity exerted by that star basically changed the direction of the light that was passing by it. So too, the National Security Establishment really warped all of the aspects of the Manson investigation from what would normally be seen. And to his credit, Tom O'Neill followed those leads wherever they went, despite the fact that it was clearly going over into area that was viewed as, quote, conspiracy theory, and that could have been easily dismissed by people who did not want to take a look at the facts. So again, I think the behavior of Tom O'Neill as a journalist, he was not only a mainstream writer, but a showbiz writer, writing an article for Premier Magazine in 1999, and he followed the case where it went, and basically that was almost two decades before he finally published his book, and I think his behavior was exemplary. One of the things about O'Neill's investigation is that it eventually came upon things involved with the assassination of JFK. In our last program, I noted that Louis Jolyon West, or Jolly West, a CIA psychiatrist who was deeply involved in the MKUltra program, was also Jack Ruby's psychiatrist and opined that Jack Ruby had a brief psychomotor epileptic episode or something that caused him to just shoot Lee Harvey Oswald, and he had no memory of that. Eventually, although Oswald in his interview, Ruby in his interview with the Warren Commission is something that I have dealt with in a number of programs, although Ruby at one point, following a question from Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission and later, of course, named by Richard Nixon as his vice president. He then became president when Nixon resigned during the Watergate scandal. When Gerald Ford asked Ruby, quote, "By that you mean a party to the plot of Oswald," meaning that Ruby was part of a plot with Oswald, and Ruby said, quote, "I'm trying to tell you that I'm part of a plot to silence Oswald," unquote. Eventually, however, Ruby, after having been coached by Jolly West, Ruby said, nope, he killed Oswald, but that was not part of a conspiracy. One of the things that Tom O'Neill noted in the book was that some of the people he had come across, journalists he had come across, who were involved with crafting the, quote, final version, unquote, or official version, unquote, of the massive killings, have also been involved with the reportage about the assassination of JFK and reviewed with a jaundiced eye by a number of people involved with the JFK assassination or investigating the JFK assassination because, in their opinion, these journalists, a fellow named Lawrence Schiller, who is still alive, someone we looked at in our interviews with Jinbi Eugenio. We did 25 one-hour interviews about B. Eugenio's book, Destiny Betrayed, and we talked about Lawrence Schiller in those interviews. Another fellow who was involved with the Manson case and that also tracks back to the investigation into JFK's assassination, and someone who was viewed as being an obstructionist in connection with attempts to get the truth out about the JFK assassination, a fellow named Jerry Cohen, along with Lawrence Schiller, cropped up in connection with the Manson case, and they were involved, according to Tom O'Neill, with hoping to craft the official version of the Manson case, and they were also involved with what many journalists and researchers viewed as a refractory role in helping to defer people who were looking into JFK's assassination. Richard Caballero, by the way, is an attorney who was representing Susan Atkins and apparently helped to effect a book that came out authored by Lawrence Schiller. Richard Caballero refused to discuss the case with me. "The answer is no thank you," he said on the phone. I asked him why not. "The answer is no thank you," he said. I tried one more time, saying I wanted to discuss the sale of the Atkins story. Quote, "The answer is no thank you," he shouted, hanging up the phone. Lawrence Schiller wouldn't talk to me either, and Jerry Cohen had died by his own hand in 1993. Looking into those two men, I found that throughout the 60s, their journalism had often gotten them mixed up in furtive arrangements. In 1967, Schiller had published the first book to attack the conspiracy theorists around JFK's assassination, staunchly supporting the official explanation for JFK's death. That same year, foreshadowing his feat at Sybil Brand, Schiller wormed his way into the Dallas hospital room of Jack Ruby, who'd killed Kennedy's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. The reporter emerged with the only recording ever made of Ruby's confessing to the murder. Schiller released it on vinyl that year. Notably, he taped Ruby saying that he hadn't killed Oswald as part of a conspiracy, thus shoring up the government's official line. During a congressional investigation of the CIA's illegal domestic operations, the agency admitted that it had more than 250 assets, unquote, in the American media in the 1960s. Their identities were never revealed. Mark Lane, who'd written the first book questioning the findings of the Warren Commission, the investigative committee appointed by President Lyndon Johnson, which concluded that Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin, believed Schiller was one of those assets, and Jerry Cohen as well. Lane believed they'd been tasked with disrupting investigations of the Kennedy assassination. In testimony before Congress, Lane charged that the CIA had paid Cohen to, quote, smear, unquote, him in the press. I was never able to prove that, but I did find a trove of documents in the National Archives showing that Schiller had been acting as an informant for the FBI in 1967 and 1968, sharing confidential information with the Bureau about Mark Lane's sources. His work as an informant continued under the cloak of his reporting, unquote, for Life magazine, which was later named in a 1977 Rolling Stone story as one of the publications that provided CIA employees with cover. Schiller tracked down authorities who were investigating potential malfeasance in the JFK assassination, using his press credentials to obtain interviews, and then shared his findings with the FBI. He'd written to J. Edgar Hoover to say that he was, quote, in possession of the names and whereabouts of the confidential informant whom Mr. Mark Lane refused to identify, unquote, in his testimony to the Warren Commission. Schiller dug up information about officials looking into the CIA's involvement in the Kennedy assassination. According to memos, the FBI eagerly awaited Schiller's information. Others have made similar claims about Cohen and Schiller. Peter Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, a TV investigative reporter who'd written a book on the assassinations of President Kennedy and his brother Robert, said that Cohen, a friend, had pressured him to abandon the project. If Noyes dropped the publication of the book, Cohen promised him a plum job at the Los Angeles Times. Noyes declined the offer, but he was disturbed by how much Cohen knew about his unpublished work. A few weeks later, Noyes was fired from his job at CBS News. Cohen was, quote, a strange little guy, unquote, Noyes told me. He wondered why his one-time friend tried to quash his book, and he suspected that Cohen had played a role in his firing as well. Although he could never prove it, Noyes was fairly certain that Cohen was a CIA asset. And I would note that Jerry Cohen's, quote, suicide, unquote, happened not too long after, it happened in the aftermath of the movie JFK, which massively reawakened interest in the assassination of JFK, also led to the declassification, finally, of a great many documents. The parts of Tom O'Neill's book about the JFK assassination are not, in my opinion, some of the stronger material about it, but I think O'Neill, again, deserves tremendous credit for having followed the evidentiary pathways that weave through the Manson operation and lead beyond wherever they went. It was resourceful and persevering and very brave, frankly, professionally speaking, for Tom O'Neill to have risked the discreditation that can come from looking into what most people disdain as, ew, that's conspiracy theory. Be careful you don't get any on your shoes, unquote. That dynamic in many ways, I think, could be said to embrace the death of democracy in this country. Whenever credible information comes up about the destruction of democratic process in this country through assassination or covert operation, eventually it comes out that people will just dismiss that as conspiracy theory, that mainstream politicians, journalists, and others refuse to recognize what has taken place. And sadly, I think their discussion of Donald Trump's shenanigans having attacked or besmirched or compromised American democracy are decades late. Again, that democracy had its brains blown all over the back of a limousine in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas, just past noon on November 22nd of 1963. And this concludes For the Record program number 1165, Farewell America, Part 4, The Reeve Whitson File, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 22nd of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.